Good morning. I'm Scott Alexander. I'm the minister of your sister congregation in Vero Beach, where Kathy and Charlie are this morning. They came over yesterday afternoon. We took a swim in my pool. We had dinner on the beach, and we had a good old time, and I left them at my home this morning, and I did the drive over here. So that was that's what an exchange looks like. I don't know how many of you have been to the Vero Beach congregation. You know, we have we bought a failed evangelical church, so we have a 1,000-seat sanctuary and 375 parking spaces and a 33,000 square foot building. So it's going to be a little while till we go to two services, but just a little while. I'll fill it in no time, but it's going to take a little while. I understand that you had some excitement here last Sunday. I'm glad you have no more excitement here. I'm also proud of you for not being reactive. You know, the kind of resistance that you witnessed to progressive values, I think, is the same fear and anxiety that led to the tragedy in Norway this weekend. People just do not want to accept a new world that is emerging, and we always need to be quietly confident in our views while never dismissing those of others. Before I share the reading this morning, I do want to tell you a little bit about myself because it'll help you to understand the sermon. I'm an endurance athlete and have been for my whole life. I'm an aging endurance athlete. Come April, I'm going to take my third charity ride from Los Angeles to Savannah. I'm hoping to raise $30,000 to alleviate hunger, about $15,000 for a food bank we have in Vero, and $15,000 for a global program. And but I want you to know that I'm an aging athlete who's trying to keep it up. So that'll help you understand the sermon. My reading is simply entitled Spiritual Fitness, and it's an anonymous reading. And if you go online and Google spiritual fitness, I think this will pop up. If you can start the day without caffeine or pep pills, if you can be cheerful, ignoring your aches and pains, if you can resist complaining and boring people with your troubles, if you can understand it when loved ones are too busy to give you time, if you can overlook it when people take things out on you when, through no fault of your own, something goes wrong, if you can take criticism and blame without resentment, if you can face the world without lies and deceit, if you can conquer tension without medical help, if you can relax without liquor, if you can sleep without the aid of drugs, then you are probably a dog. Here ends the morning reading. So it's the middle of May, 2008, and I'm in an orthopedist's office in Fort Smith, Arkansas, having made it more than halfway across this marvelous big country of ours on a 27-day, 3,000-mile, 120-mile-a-day charity ride. And I'm waiting in Fort Smith to see an orthopedist who will inject my badly arthritic knees with a high-tech lubricant made from chicken combs, of all things. And by the way, that the drug is great, except the next morning you wake up and you say, cock-a-doodle-doo. So I'm in this waiting room, and I look down, and there on the top of the stack of magazines is a magazine with my name on it, Geezer Jock. I kid you not, Geezer Jock magazine, there really was such a thing. It's now an online magazine called Master Athlete, which I suppose is a little more dignified. But, you know, this magazine was just full of, I had to make this one up because they no longer publish it, full of great stories about aging athletes who don't want to admit that they're slowing down and don't want to, they want to deceive themselves, basically. Recently I read in the online version about some retired guy who was paddling for prostate alone in a kayak from Chicago out through the St. Lawrence Seaway to Miami, And then there was this great article about Tiger Woods, and he's going to, apparently, according to this article, he won't hit his stride as a golfer for at least two more decades. You know, in Geezer Jock, we get to make up all kinds of things. Is this a great country or what? Surely you are all familiar with Ben Franklin's famous quote, "But in this world, nothing is certain but death and taxes." But that, of course, is not quite right. There is a third thing certain in life, and that, of course, is the inexorable process of aging. All of us, regardless of how young or old we are constantly, slowly yet steadily aging every day. We pay taxes only once a year on April 15th, and for most of us, death is only a pressing reality at the very end of our lives. But every day we wake up, we must all face the fact that we are inevitably aging. Every day our minds and bodies get older, and every one of us must continuously cope with all the ramifications of that, both good and bad. It matters, of course, that each one of us tries to age as well and gracefully as we can. Surely every person in this room right now, regardless of your chronological age this morning, you hope to age with dignity and grace and live as long as you can with just as much quality of life as possible. That's, of course, a kind of a universal desire. Now, a lot of people I know are rather fatalistic about the aging process. Many people believe that the key factor in aging well is, as the saying goes, to choose your parents well, which is a cute way of saying that it is one's familial genetics which play a foundational, significant role in how you're going to age. And I don't think you'll find any expert in the field of human aging who will deny that one's genetics, the DNA cards that you are dealt at birth from your parents and grandparents and other ancestors, have a lot to say not only about how long you will live, but also about the quality of life which will be possible for you. In every congregation I have served, and I've been at this for 39 years, I have been able to watch and enjoy a handful of truly remarkable older members who age so gracefully and well, like those 80-year-olds we heard about who were scuba diving and biking. You all know people like this. One of these folks is a 93-year-old gal named Sally from my congregation in Bethesda, Maryland, which I left a year ago. She still teaches women in their 30s water aerobics three times a week and is very, very active in our congregation there. And I asked her once what she attributed this longevity to, and she said, "Well, I don't know, but my 103-year-old sister could probably tell you." Another example is Muriel Davies, the widow of the great 20th century Unitarian preacher A. Powell Davies, who was also in my congregation in Bethesda. She died last year, bless her heart, at the age of 104, still sharp as a tack, right up to her last week on earth. And amazing, lived a very full life until the very last week. Once I called her, when I was checking in on her, and I was working on a sermon on aging, and I said, "Muriel, what do you attribute this to?" And she said, "Honestly, Scott, I have absolutely no idea." And then I said, "Well, could it be your optimistic personality that you're always looking for something new to devote yourself to?" And she said, "Well, maybe, but I really just think I'm lucky." The truth is that genetics, while important on the luck side of things, the truth is that they have less to say about how we age than most people think. In a wonderful article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years back, "What Science Tells Us About Getting Older and Staying Healthy," staff reporter Tara Parker Hope did a comprehensive study of all the recent studies on successful aging. I quote from the beginning of her article. "Today, the average person in the United States lives for 78 years. But what about those people who beat the average? Why do some men and women defy the chronological odds and live longer and in good health? Increasingly," she goes on, "the scientific community is shifting its focus too, this elite group, these successful agers, just seem to be doing such a better job of getting old than the rest of us. Now, what the scientists are finding is that each of us has much more control over how well and successfully we age than we like to think. I now quote Reverend Dr. John Rowe, who is the director of the MacArthur Foundation research on successful aging. People feel there is a genetic program they are playing out. But since only in our studies we found that only a third of this is heritable, aging is heritable, and the key study here is conducted in Sweden by twins who grew up apart. Only a third is heritable. The rest, he writes, is acquired. That means you are responsible for your own old age. And then he goes on and writes, numerous studies of rats, monkeys, nuns, and British government workers. Rats, monkeys, nuns, and British government workers have unlocked many of the secrets of successful aging. And what are these secrets? You might well want to know. It turns out, of course, that the most important components are not secrets at all. Right off the bat, there are several obvious and long scientifically established things that are under our control as persons, which help us to age successfully. You all know the list. It's the stuff we regularly and variously feel guilty for failing to entirely do. But we all know that if you want to have a chance to live a long and happy life, you need to eat the right foods and eat them in moderation. And of course, if you drink alcohol, to do that in moderation as well. To maintain a healthy body weight, to exercise regularly, which many scientists agree is the single most important good health habit that contributes to one's longevity on Earth. You must avoid smoking and harmful drugs, of course. And last but not least, an underappreciated thing in American life, get plenty of sleep. Now, I know some of you don't want to hear it in church, but I would be remiss in my role as a spiritual leader, even a visiting one, if I didn't regularly remind you that the foundational importance of establishing good everyday lifestyle habits that are under your control and are proven beyond any doubt to enable us to be fit, alert, productive, healthy, and long-living human beings. Just as it matters in a UU congregation what we believe and what values and principles we uphold, like those you upheld last weekend when you were being attacked, and how we treat other human beings and what we devote our lives to, these things are all important. It also matters that we practice good personal self-care. You know, let me put it this way. Our job as Unitarian Universalists is to be around in this world for as long and effectively as we reasonably can, contributing. We are called to contribute from our hearts and our minds to making this world a better place. And we can't do that unless we take care of ourselves. In a world, we have the responsibility to be wise and disciplined stewards of these amazingly fragile things which house the rest of the things we think are important about our humanness. So, as I have repeatedly preached in every congregation I've ever served, as we work over our lifetimes to become the finest and most useful human beings we can, there can be no successful separation between the spiritual, the intellectual, and the physical. We have to pay attention. You know, we human beings come into this world as one incredible package deal. And so as we work as Unitarian Universalists at shaping our lives into everything that it can become, we must not neglect the bodies we are given. Now, of course, and this is a crucial caveat and a quite unpleasant truth in life, of course, no amount of proper self-care, eating right, exercising, watching our weight, avoiding harmful substances, getting lots of sleep, none of this can or necessarily will protect us from many of the most dire, random hazards of life. Everyone in this room knows wonderful, healthy individuals who have done almost everything right for their physical selves and still have their lives cut tragically short by a random act or illness. No amount, of course, of right or careful or disciplined living will necessarily protect you from many forms of early death. Car accidents, crime, cancer, neurological and vascular diseases like ALS, Parkinson's, aneurysm, Alzheimer's, just to name a few of the twists of physical fate that do not really care how well you have cared for yourself. This world is full of tragedies and diseases that will prevent some of us from leading a long, happy life. At the same time, several experts on human aging have now recently asserted that, quote, if nothing goes wrong, a human person might expect to live to 120, which is 6 times 20 years old, which is when your body reaches its physical maturity. But the sad fact, of course, is that for many of us, something will go wrong. Things do go wrong, often decades before that imaginary maximum lifespan of 120. That simply is the luck of the cards. But that said, the overall point here about successful aging is that each of us are nonetheless responsible to be the wisest and most caring stewards of our bodies and our lives of which we are capable. Now, I'm promising you this will not be a Jack LaLanne sermon where I just talk about physical fitness. By the way, he died last year, you know. You know what his famous mantra? Exercise is the king, diet is the queen, and together they make the kingdom. I like it. I'm not just going to talk about physical self-care. What a whole lot of recent medical studies have discovered is that the most significant enemy of old age is not being sedentary or overweight or out of shape. The largest enemy of old age is, in fact, stress. Unremitting, unresolved chronic stress. It is stress, particularly stress that is not somehow shedded or gotten rid of, that ends up taking years off our life. I quote from the Wall Street Journal article again, how much stress we face in a lifetime and how well we cope with it is one of the most significant factors for predicting how well we age. Unremitting stress, they write, in a person who cannot get rid of it, who cannot shed it, leaves the stress response that protects us in moments of danger, like if we meet a tiger in the woods, that stress response. All of these changes, heart rate, blood pressure, and the kind of chemical changes in the body when you're in a crisis, turn on you if you don't get rid of the stress at some point and take a dramatic toll on your body and its immune system. And then they conclude, the healthiest agers are particularly adept at shedding stress. Now, of course, all of us regularly experience stress in our lives. There is no such thing as stress-free living, and we live in a stressful culture, even when Congress is getting along, not leading us toward a debt crisis. We live in a stressful world, and studies have revealed that normal day-to-day stress is not by itself necessarily terribly detrimental. What is deadly is not having the mechanisms or modalities or habits in your life that allow you to relieve the stress, to let go of it, to manage it in ways that let you maintain a healthy, balanced, relaxed life. People who age well, study after study suggests, somehow have learned how to dissipate the stress and tension in their lives. Now, I'm sure there are many ways that you all variously shed or relieve yourselves of stress. I want to just give you a few that work for me. The first for me is regular exercise. Getting out on my bicycle every day, one of the reasons I moved to Florida is there's no snow here. It makes biking a lot easier. You know, I give my body a good run for its money every day, and it works its calming magic on whatever has got me tensed up. Often when I go out for a bike ride at noon, I'll come back to the office. Old problems will seem much clearer and more manageable. A good physical workout every day helps you, in fact, to work out what has you tense and tied up in knots. And by the way, did you all know that recently the World Health Organization reported that the simple act of regularly riding a bicycle, like the majority of people in Denmark do, reduces your mortality rate by 40%, and on average will add, are you ready for this, 20 years to your life. Dig out that old Schwinn, kids. Dig out that old Schwinn. Bike riding and countless other forms of physical exercise, as simply as walking each day or getting in the pool and doing some laps, is perhaps the greatest stress-reducing, life-enhancing technique that I use in my life, and many of you do too. My second secret to stress reduction is the simple practice of regularly getting a good night's sleep. Every day I discipline myself to get at least 7 or 8 hours, and studies have shown that Americans are getting less and less and less sleep. They're plugged into their BlackBerries and their iPads till 2 in the morning and all of this stuff. They're not getting enough sleep. I've given up the 11 o'clock news. Many nights I give up on the 10 o'clock news. You cannot minimize how important sleep is, so simple and yet so powerfully beneficial. Get enough of it. Third, I shed stress and maintain balance in my life by keeping my work life and my home life significantly separated from one another. By routinely compartmentalizing and separating my personal from my professional life, I am able to give each of those their due. Increasingly, we hear about employers who expect their employees to check their business emails overnight, be writing memos at 8 o'clock at night. This is not healthy. And all you have to do is say no, or if your boss won't let you, find another job. When I leave my office in Vero Beach each evening by bike, and by the way, I often see those fantastic Florida sunsets. We've got the best clouds in America in Florida. I go home and do home things and family things. That's a key way to reduce stress. Have a home safe from work. What a novel idea. And fourth, I manage my stress by maintaining a strong network of family and friends. A lot of longevity studies have proven that friends and family are crucial to those who age well. And of course, a central piece of that, I happen to be blessed with a spouse of 30 years. Having a spouse backed up with the care and support of other family and friends simply means that I do not have to go through the stresses and strains of life alone. Simply put, I have someone who cares about me in a special way with whom I can shed stress and share problems. You don't need a spouse or a partner, of course, to lead a long and happy life. I mean, Noah and the Ark, you know, everybody went 2 by 2. You don't have to go 2 by 2 in the world. But what you do need is a network of caring, of friends and family, and all such networks require cultivation. You can never have a garden unless you cultivate it, and a garden of family and friends requires you to do weeding and phoning and staying in touch. So these are my personal stress reducers: exercise, sleep, compartmentalizing my life, and maintaining a network of friends. What do you use in your life to shed your stress? There are many. Ballroom dancing works. Walking the dog around your neighborhood. Taking a yoga class. I've already mentioned gardening. Cooking. Knitting. Stamp collecting. Parenting. Playing in a rock band. Participating in a book discussion group. Taking an afternoon nap. Aren't those wonderful? Swimming laps in the pool. Take your pick. The only key is picking things that work for you to shed that stress that is so deadly in American life. As I have already mentioned, recent studies suggest that men and women who age well have spent a lifetime building and cultivating that network, that nexus of friends and family. Again, the Wall Street Journal. Successful agers are not loners. People who age well tend to be close to extended family and have a strong network of friends and other social relationships, which can be built in church. Study after study has shown that active relationships with friends and family translates into emotional support, makes a significant difference in the ability to age well. In a recent New York Times article, there was an article about Esther Tuttle in the New York Times. She's booming along at 102, and she is described in the New York Times article as an extrovert with many friends who pursues her passions with opera and her grandchildren. This may not be good news for those of you yearning for an early retirement, but recent studies also indicate that people who retire early and retreat into a simple life of just fishing by themselves in Florida, they do not live as long as people who stay engaged in communities, in congregations. The Japanese have a word for this. They call an engaged and purposeful life after retirement ikigai. Ikigai. Post-retirement ikigai, the reason for which we wake up in the morning. Meaningful engagement with family and friends is a meaningful activity of mind and body. And I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you there are also a whole host of studies that say that one of the best places to maintain this healthy network are in religious congregations. There are a bunch of studies that say they prove that being a member of a church adds years and years to your life. One study, the National Institute for Healthcare Research, says that participation in a church increases men's longevity by 30% and women's by 60%. I don't know how they come up with these figures. And another study says that going to church simply adds 3.1 years to your life. So the good news is that churches are really, really good for you. And that church pledge you pay? Oh, simple down payment on a 100-year life. Hey, I'm not allowed to make any of this stuff up. You know, in seminary, we sign a voucher saying we'll never misguide a congregation with the truth. Come to church. It'll keep you alive forever. And this brings me to the last key factors the social scientists have identified in those who successfully age and age happily and well. In a major study of hundreds of retired Roman Catholic nuns, sisters who, you know, all basically eat the same diet and live in the same kinds of environment, okay? The nuns who aged the best were those who were blessed with one, optimistic personalities, two, a healthy sense of humor, and three, and this is the crucial one that the scientists think, the nuns that aged the best had the ability and willingness to adapt to new circumstances, welcomed or unwelcomed in their life. For example, if a nun found herself restricted to a wheelchair, instead of saying, poor me, the optimistic nun would say, now what? Now what? Now how do I live? Given this new, unwelcomed information in my life that my legs won't carry me, now what? That's the key question. Now, one might argue that qualities like an optimistic personality, a sense of humor, the ability to adapt are genetic, are inborn, that you can't cultivate those things like exercise and diet. In fact, I'm pretty sure that while all of us do have some control over our personalities and the way we react to environmental circumstances, there's some truth to this, that we're born with a certain kind of personality. Last summer, I was on Cape Cod. Now, I'm a very cheerful guy. I'm a very optimistic guy. My spouse finds this insufferable at 6:20 in the morning. So we're on the Cape Cod Bike Canal, you know, beautiful woods, and we're tearing down along near Brewster. And I say, there's this writing, and somebody had written something on the middle of the road. And I said, Collins, I said, look, somebody wrote smile. And he said, that's not smile. That's 5 mile. I saw a smile. I'm an optimist. What can I tell you? And you know what? The fact that I see smile means I've probably got 5 more years than the person who sees 5 mile. That's what I think. Half serious. Well, you're all about half an hour older than when I started, so it's time for me to wrap things up because life is short and you've got more stuff to do this summer afternoon. I want to summarize. Scientists are telling us that there are a number of diverse and in some cases interlocking factors which allow us to age successfully, well, and live long. Good genetics clearly plays a role, so choose your parents well. So does a good diet, weight control, regular exercise. Boy, do I believe in that. Getting plenty of sleep, that shouldn't be too hard. Knowing how to handle stress, cultivating a strong network of family and friends, and last but not least, having an optimistic, fun-loving, and the key word, adaptable personality that knows how to roll with life's inevitable stresses and tensions and necessary losses. Now again, we can't control all the things in our aging, but the good news is that we have a lot to say through our choices and our habits and our emotional reactions about how this life journey will go for us. So do what you can to enhance and enrich and extend your lives. It matters deeply, as I've said, that you hang around this planet for as long as you can and make your contributions to the world. That duty is part of what it means to be a Unitarian Universalist. You have a contribution to make, and you can't make it if you're decrepit before you should be decrepit. You know, of course, the ascorbic actress Betty Davis was right when she famously said, "Getting old is not for sissies." As the years and the decades go by, we must all face an infinite number of diminishments, complications, and challenges, some of which may greatly diminish or even prematurely end our lives. Some of that is in the luck of the draw. But what I would spiritually remind you in leaving you this morning is that in many significant, important ways, we are not helpless victims as we face the increasing challenges of every decade. We have a lot to say about how this journey is going to go to us. We have great freedom to make positive choices that will extend and enrich our days upon earth. So no matter how old you are, I send you on your way by saying, get out there and live long and well. It's just that simple. Live long and well. Amen. Life is the greatest gift of all. The riches on this earth, life and its creatures, great and small, of high and lowly birth. So treasure it and measure it with deeds of shining worth. Go in peace into this summer and live well.